Good afternoon. This is always a difficult session. And the reason it's difficult is because I have a daunting challenge, and that challenge is to keep you energized at a time where you've spent the best part of the energy of your day experiencing something else. And if you're like me, you should be ready to take a nap by now. Because we are engaging in the context of return, it is very, very important to understand that God uses all of those to be able to carry out his mission. So just a very brief overview of where we were so that we can catch up to where we are going. We started off with telling our story. And our story from a pure heart vision perspective is to understand that the walls in our life become part of who we are, and they are manifested as memories. And memories is what we rely on to be able to keep us connected with ourselves. God, through the power of the Godhead, has worked from the beginning of time until the end of time to take care of all things that pertain to life and godliness. And although our focus will be on Nehemiah this afternoon, it will be with understanding that we have to know our story. Our story consists of what happens when the wall in our life becomes a memory. The picture that we see is that of ancient Jerusalem. The artist's depiction is a place of beauty, structure, established by God for his purpose and his people. It was a vibrant and growing city, very similar to Circe, but also with some unique challenges because the vibrancy and the growingness caused a deterioration, so much so that the walls of the city became broken. Just as what we see on the periphery. When we look at Harding University, this is an open campus. It doesn't have gates, but there's a possibility that may come a time the city may have to be necessary to be wall. And if it gets wall, then the gates will be broken. And when the gates are broken, it becomes a place of vulnerability for things to come in that we don't want to have. I call them spiritual dogs, wolves, and thieves that are designed to prey on those who dwell within. And so consequently, what we see is this. Once the walls are broken and the gates are open, it will ultimately affect the fabric of the city, and the city will go into ruin. What does this represent? Those negative memories are associated with the survivors of this distress, while Nehemiah is a representation of our church leadership and our congregations, are representative of our families and individuals who we're dealing with. And what is that? There it is. This is what's happened to God's people. God's people have become scattered. And when that happens, it affects people. I'm going to show you this, how it works again. Typically, when individuals start off, they start off connected. They're together. And they walk and work hand in hand. When we're talking about hand in hand, nearly every relationship that we deal with starts off on a cohesive, connective manner. Then what happens? Division occurs. Just as during Nehemiah's day. When people become unfaithful, their belief system begins to change. And this is what happens. And it affects two of the institutions that we have to have some understanding of. It is God himself who established the home. That's the first level of breakdown. The second thing God established was government. It is God himself who decided during the days of Noah that he would build an ark because the people could no longer be governed. And is also God himself who established the church. Those three great institutions, home, government, and church, are God's design. He was law. He was government. When this breaks down, the people have become unfaithful. They become scattered. Now we have to rely on the human ingenuity to be able to produce what God desires. That's within the framework of telling our story. When you read Nehemiah's story, you can see that he is a great man of vision as enacted by God's preparation for him to work in a governmental institution of the kingdom. And this kingdom that he went to was divided because the walls were broken in the city. The city was in ruin. And even though Ezra came along to be able to establish the temple, and later on Esther to be able to enact those things to bring the temple together and the culture together, the city was still a mess. Whether you like it or not, go to any city in America. And if the city, excuse me, I'm from Arkansas, from the outskirts, looks like it's in ruin, looks like it's someplace that no one wants to be, the tendency is to hurry up and get through there so I don't have to deal with it. That is what has happened in our homes, in our government, and in our churches. Here's the pattern. It starts with mistrust between church leaders. Comes from the broken wall. The shepherd and the preacher begin to become insecure as a result of circumstances that they view that have the ability to become detracted and deteriorated. And then their family issues. Said another way, if there are not healthy families, how can there be healthy churches? We expect government to be the answer to some of our problems, but does government have healthy families? When there's a breakdown in the home, every institution of God is impacted. And it produces negative memories. The negative memories of traditionalism is often a prelude to marital breakdown. Grandmother did that way. You ever heard that story? Grandmother always prepared a turkey for Thanksgiving. And she also prepared a roast. And in the country, that's where country folks live that know about pigs and hogs and cows, she also baked a ham. Well, in this story, Grandma used to bake a ham, but she cut it in half. She cut the ham in half, have all of her dinner, and everything would be good for Thanksgiving dinner. And Thanksgiving is an important traditional holiday that many Americans honor and keep. But in this occasion, it was Mother's time to prepare the dinner. So Mother would bake the turkey, bake the roast, and cut the ham. Finally, at the dinner table, there's always a grandchild who will ask a stupid question. Why did you cut the ham in half? Well, I don't know. That's what your grandmother always did. That's what I did. Well, she's here. Why don't you ask her? I said, well, I cut the ham because I had a small oven. And a big ham wouldn't fit in it. You know, sometimes people do something for so long, we forget why we started them. And as a result, we keep a tradition going, and it doesn't make sense. And it'll produce a negative memory. Who wants a half-cut ham? Consequently, these things happen with God's people, and it produces not only generational issues, but generational gaps, membership decline among churches, and apathy among our youth when people are scattered. The memory of the wall has consequences, and the consequences are within the framework of the home and the survival of it. But what God orchestrates through this process is pain. And when pain comes, in order to overcome pain, we have to have a spirit of humility that requires the guts enough to admit that something needs to change, warranting prayer, because we really have to deal with our shame. You ever heard this expression? You ought to be ashamed of yourself. That started in the garden. Shame started in the garden. And the first picture we have of it is in the opposite. The two were naked and unashamed. Naked and unashamed meant that they walked around naked. Now, it's very interesting to note this. I don't care how beautiful we look on the outside, when people start walking around naked, shame comes. Hello. Shame comes. It's one thing for that to happen, but that is typically the process that God wants to take us back to, a place where we are absolutely transparent before Him by facilitating honesty with ourselves. This is Nehemiah's story. He goes to the king. He goes out of a spirit of humility, but he doesn't go with words. He goes with countenance. Cupbearer, and you walking around looking like you just been poisoned, that's going to elicit some response from the king. So why is your countenance falling? The king would ask the question, and here's the answer. Because my home, my people, and my church, and everything that is near and dear to me because of my relationship with God is broken, in ruins, on fire, and I need to go do something about it. That's power. That's power within the framework of what God will do to help us survive. So he wants us to see that in order for the people to be divided, how the division occurs. See, when we tell our story, one of the things that God requires is absolute spiritual honesty. And you have to be spiritually honesty, and I'm not talking about fleshly honesty. Spiritually honest with yourself. I'm not as smart as I'd like to be. I'm not as handsome and as young as I'd like to be. But am I accepting of the fact of who I am? Well, let's examine it. How do we talk to ourselves? When we talk to ourselves, you ever done something stupid? I like that word because it's a biblical word. Proverbs chapter 30 says, when God is talking about the king Agur, he says, I am more stupid than any man. You ever said that to yourself? I say sometimes, Jesse, that was so stupid. Because I am a stupid man sometimes. You don't have to convince me, but sometimes it might help to remind me. Now, this is how I'd like you to say it. Brother Trice, are you sure that's what you want to do? Sounds a little bit more politically correct, doesn't it? Now, if you say to me, I'm stupid, and you really don't know me, you might forget I'm a military man. To that end, when we're dealing with ourselves, the breakdown in homes start with how we talk to one another. I use this model often as a communication model. Have you seen husbands and wives discuss things? Says, honey, I saw Obama on 60 Minutes last week, and he said some profound things. Well, that's not true. Now I'm going to give you a cure. Instead of saying that's not true, try this one. Well, help me understand what you mean. Nehemiah did that. The city is in ruins. The walls of Jerusalem are falling down. And I want to go and survey the land. So the king's wife asked, well, how long will you be away? It's important to understand that Nehemiah completed the wall of Jerusalem literally in 52 days. Now, how many of our churches can get something done in 52 days? Think about it. When we see this and how we talk to each other, we communicate that. Here are some of them that divides God's people. Here we go again. That's the elders meeting. What is it this time? That's somebody coming asking for help. That's ridiculous. Which literally means, it's a mental health phrase, it literally means you're out of your mind. That's a lie. Meaning, I have truth, you don't. You're wrong. You're wrong. Notice the pointing. You're wrong. It's really, I'm wrong and you're wrong too. That's a lie. Lies always come in multiples. Satan was the father of lies and a murderer. He lies in order to lie because that's his nature. And when we start using that kind of nature, it tears up homes. It tears up governments. It tears up churches. I never said that. And my favorite, you don't know what you're talking about. Now, because we are educated and sophisticated in our communication, we use words that literally tear people apart. when we don't have their best interest at heart, because we've adapted a complex of superiority. When Nehemiah went to the governor, or the king rather, he was humble in his spirit, strategic in his words, and deliberate with his desire to accomplish a goal of God. And here's what we see when we're looking at the challenge. He needed to prepare for challenge. In order to prepare for the challenge, there are several concepts, and I use these words here because you really can't buy these at Walmart. He needed an idea of understanding, an understanding heart to know that there will be some things that Nehemiah himself would have to do. The second thing he needed was an idea of empathy. In other words, what is it like? Have you ever asked yourself, what is it like to go into a home of somebody whose home is exclusively broken, torn up, and you're 21 years old? What are you going to do? What do you offer someone whose mother has died, and as a result of that death, they really don't know what they're going to do? What do you do when you see people that are in need and you don't even know how to define the need because you have no relationship to it? Nehemiah had the ability to do surveillance operations. And when he went into Jerusalem to do surveillance operation, he went at night. Here's the testimony. There are many powerful things of God that occur at night. I don't have the time to go into them, but the night gave him a perspective of what things would look like when we don't have a clear perspective of light. Brokenness doesn't look so bad at night because it's clothed in darkness. But when we see it in the light, we get a clear picture. That's the first step in reconciliation. And reconciliation is he needed to be right with himself, he needed to be right with the government, he needed to be right with the king. That included love and respect, and then he asked God to give him the grace that occurred from the people who were committed to rising up and building. And in doing so, when we deal with people, when we're preparing for a challenge of building, here are some attributes. And the reason I use these attributes, attitude plays a big role in getting something done now or later. Young people, when you're getting ready to study, if your attitude is right, you might as well put your books up. You're not going to get anything. Your mind is going to go to la-la land. That's a place where no learning occurs. And in that framework, you have to reconnect your attitude with yourself by doing three simple things. Be kind to yourself as you learn how to be kind with others. Trust in God, not yourself. And then accept others because you have to learn how to walk somewhat in their shoes. That's part of the story that we told earlier today. But this is nothing more than a segue into our challenges. And in order to face our challenges, all walls have to be built together. Remind me about this one. This is our wall that we create in our own lives that are designed to stabilize us. When we see how it happens, however, is that we have to understand the connectivity is we must work together in order to rebuild anything that's broken. Number two, we have to guard against discouragement. Every time you want to start a good work, and if you don't have any opposition, I would go back and pray to God and find out, Lord, give me the opposition because I know I need to remain steadfast. If there's no encouragement, Satan is in the middle of it. Then we build the process. It isn't amazing that the very people who do not want you to succeed always get in the way to destroy you. Why is that? It's because God always requires resistance in order for human beings to rely on him. And here's the picture. In the building process, I like these images. We establish three sets of processes that we can refer to as objectives or goals. In every building process, no matter what it is, there must be roles defined from the beginning or the person who is in charge of the undertaking all the way down to the person who has the least amount of responsibility. There are rules. There are rules that govern work. How many of you have ever worked at a place, a business, where there was no rule in terms of when you came to work or not? Then you had an undefined role that resulted in eclectic rules that will lead to chaos unless there was some discipline there. And the reason this is significant is because roles and rules also require rights in order to carry out responsibilities to fulfill those rituals and realities. And I shared this. You have the right to remain. You weren't supposed to say anything. You have the right to remain. Anything you say can and will be used against you. Now, how many are adept at emotional suicide? That's saying things to hurt yourself. In Nehemiah's spiritual vineyard, he learned not to say things to people that did not warrant a conversation. In doing so, he wanted to restore those things that had begun to be restored through the ministry of Ezra in the temple. There's something about building things. The program has to warrant necessity to build before we build the infrastructure to be able to house it. So there are some rituals and realities. The connection of rituals are predicated on those traditions that we need in order to maintain the integrity. And one of the best traditions I know is the one that is coming up next month called Halloween. Did you hear I said it? Halloween? That's a tradition. There'll be little children, goblins and goggins and witches, running all over Cersei trying to say trick or treat. Now, where does that tradition come from? It comes from a mindset of what people believe in order to get something. Now, in the church, we use Halloween and we will ritualize it and dress it up. And we'll call it all sorts of glamorous things. We're going to call it a fellowship or a harvest outing. What we're going to do is take our kids off the street so they don't dress up looking like fools and put them into a place where they can have a spirit of decorum in the church building, getting candy. When the thought is, I should be out all here because I can get candy for a whole bunch of folks here because there's more candy in the world than there is in the church. As you think about it, how many here, raise your hand, when you were growing up, went trick-or-treating? Wonderful. I'm glad you were honest with yourselves. I don't need to see you. But it was a ritual that was developed regardless of why the purpose was assigned. God always grants successes when we understand the framework of purposes. To everything, there's a season, time, and purpose for everything under heaven. Therefore, we have to be real within the framework of our building process. That's the example we get from Nehemiah chapter 20, which is one of the few scriptures I want to read this afternoon to say what God has done. In verse 20, and I'm reading from the English Standard Bible, "But I answered them, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But you have no share, claim, or memorial in Jerusalem." This scripture affirms the work. Nehemiah says to the people, I have spoken and been ratified by God to be able to carry out this work. And I have the proper defined roles. I know what the rules are. I have exercised my rights, both orally and silently and in writing, to carry out the responsibilities so that the realities can be coincided with the rituals that are being enacted. And the wall began to be rebuilt. For those of you that are young, these are scaffolds. And every time the rebuilding starts, there are always gaps. God will send someone to fill them. What does he want? He wants people working together, partnering with God, who will develop some systems and the level of integrity necessary to carry out understanding, to carry out empathy, to carry out forgiveness, so that we can resolve conflicts by remaining faithful. And as you see how the work is going, the work in the church, the work in the home, even the work in government, brothers and sisters, is dynamic. It is not a static work designed around one person. It is designed around a group of people who have a common goal, who have the same king and a desire to carry out his will and work. And that is what interventions are. We could spend a whole year in seminars talking about how we minister to people. Here's the first level of ministry. And I start with men who become husbands, become fathers. How do you minister to the person that you sleep with? If you don't know, you better come up and ask me so I can tell you before it's everlasting and eternally too late. If you're a woman who is planning to be a wife, you must understand the process of ministry comes from this. I need you to see my depiction again. Symbolism plays a big role in how things are structured. Watch it again. The walls, when they start to come down, produce something just as they start to go up. We are constantly building walls with one another up and down throughout the process of all of our relationships. When that happens, then we start to see a change in position. As the positions are changed, we start to see a separation, and then we continue to have a unity bond in the home where husbands and wives can walk hand in hand because they're operating in accordance with the guidelines of the head. And outside interferences will dissipate. This brings us up to where we are right now today. Fearing no future. And here's the difficulty with success. Starts off with, I remember when. That was a time we used to. Well, back when I was at Harding, a long time ago, something happened. Let's take it to its point of best resistance. We understand the story in fearing no future. But when the walls were built, we have to understand the condition of where they were. That was celebration. I don't believe we celebrate enough in homes. Let me go back there. And I need to labor here for a moment. What's the celebration like in the home when your ADD child finally passes mathematics in the third grade? Or they have a difficult teacher in which they've been successful. One of the paradoxical inadequacies that occur when success is achieved falls within the context of how we reward and how we discipline individuals who don't reach a certain level of achievement. And we over-exaggerate it in this way. And to illustrate this, I will use a personal example in telling this story. I coach Little League at one time, Little League baseball. And I had a winning team because I had a winning formula. And it started with this. I brought all the kids who wanted to play Little League baseball. These are 8 and 9 year olds. And I asked them, did they want to win? And they said, yes. Because winning meant free pizza and free root beer. And that was the goal. Every time we win, we get free pizza and free root beer. Incentive? So they wanted to know, Jesse, what do we need to do to win? I said, the only thing we need to do is hit the ball. Hit the ball. Well, what about catching? I don't care about that. What about fielding? I don't care about that. What about throwing? I don't care about that. You can work on that on your own time if you think it's important. But I'm going to play the players that can hit the ball. Now, what was the logic of that? In understanding the difficulty with success, I knew based on the Little League rules that if you hit the ball, they had what we call a mercy rule. The first team to score 9 runs won. You hear the logic? Does it make sense? But they had other rules that I refused to adhere to. And the second rule said everyone would play. In my folly, I decided that I would play the best 9 hitters. And during that time, we got the option of who wanted to be home field. Home field meant that you batted last. We always opted to be visitors. So we would bat first. Game 1, 9-0. Game 2, 12-0. Game 3, 12-0. And the score went up and up and up. And finally, someone in the Little League Commission came up with a bright idea. You're not following the rules. You're not letting everyone play. So I said, ask the kids what the rules are, and they will tell you. He says, no, we want things the way that they are. Why? Because they wanted pizza and root beer. The rules were, if we can win, we get that, and that's better than baseball. And the proof was, after 6 games, we were 6-0. That's when I got fired. The commissioner fired me. Says I didn't play by the rules, and I was being a poor example to the kids. Next game, they lost. The next game, I came to watch, and they said, we want you back as coach. We haven't had pizza and root beer since you left. Sometimes we lose sight of the celebration because we're so busy with the content and conduct of the work, and we fear success for fear that somebody's, watch this, is going to be left out. But every one of my children, after the walls were rebuilt, ate pizza and drank root beer. And they loved that celebration. One nation. In Nehemiah's kingdom, after the walls are rebuilt, was a sense of accomplishment. They all celebrated. They gave praises to God. They praised each other. Now here's the paradox. They realized, after having been in Babylonian bondage, that they were exclusive and apart from the world. You can't see this very well, but look what the world does. The world brings celebration. Can you see those? You know what they are? You know what this is? I need to say this to hurt some of you. I live in the area where we have the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Los Angeles and Anaheim Angels, and we are claiming the West in the baseball world. Now, don't talk to me about all those other teams. I don't care about them. I'm already mourning over the Razorbacks' loss this past weekend. But in California, we make no bones about who we worship. We worship the sports gods. Our hypocrisy has no bounds. And it will turn churches out. It will make people be able to be honest about the fact we are not coming to church, Brother Trice, because the game is on. We will not lie. So what do? Will you come worship after the game? Well, it depends on if our team wins. Well, then we need to pray. When we're honest about results of what we're doing, remember we talked about celebrate, but we have to celebrate apart from the world. When the Angels clinch their division title, what did they do? They broke open bottles of champagne. Do you know what champagne has in it? It's called alcohol. Do you know what alcohol will do? Here's what my challenge is. And I learned this from college, being a fraternity drunk myself. Take alcohol and pour it on a surface like wood like this. And let it stay there. Then go back 3 days and look at it. Now, beer has alcohol in it. One of the things we do with all of our counseling students that are going to work on master's degrees is ask them if they've ever had alcohol, beer, wine, spirits, all of that. And here's the experiment, because in California, if you get convicted of an alcohol-related incident, you lose your license as a therapist or a psychologist. They have a great law. So that's the first thing that has to be mastered. Then, for those who've never had it, we take a hypodermic needle. And we draw a little, maybe 14 cc's of alcohol, and ask them, will they inject it? Couldn't get any volunteers. But it has the same exact effect as if you would drink it. Ethanol. It will do that. In the celebration that we looked at, there was no celebration of wine to be able to give praise, glory, and adoration to God. But this is what the world says. That's why we have so many people trying to get high. What happened to the spirit? The spirit, pharmacologically, is a stimulant. If you can't get high on God being inside you, like the children did during Nehemiah's day, I guarantee you nothing else will work very long. Consequently, apart from the world, a celebration must occur, and it starts in our homes. We have to teach it. We have to live it. We have to appreciate it. Searcy is in White County. For those of you who don't know anything about this area, White County means they don't sell alcohol in it. But go to Pulaski County. They got one of the biggest liquor warehouses I've ever seen in my entire life on the border. Go into Jackson County and Woodruff County. Those are the adjacent counties. And guess what they have? As soon as you get out of the county that is dry, in other words, they don't allow sale of alcohol. I thank God for the influence of Harding. And sometimes students can't wait to get out of here so they can go drink. Don't go out there and drink. Drink in here while it's safe so that you can get condemned, revived, restored, and reconciled. Because if you go out there, it's going to hurt you even more because your image will be destroyed. Here we're into grace. Out there we're into compliance. And the mockery of it, of the celebration, is not wise. So what do we have? The wall is completed. Celebration. Everyone is happy. That's when the work begins, brothers and sisters. This is what the work looks like. How do we manage difficulty in partnering with God? Now we add something that we never had before. We start determining what the true meaning is of the L word. Yes, we've had interventions, but interventions come, interventions go. Yes, we've had healings, but healings go and come. So does honesty and openness, depending on circumstances when we are at our lowest. But now we have life. In order to deal with the challenge of success, we go back through a life definition. And that life starts with where you are. In every phase of your life, these things change. How does it change, Brother Trice? It changes with your level of understanding. When I was in my 20s, I had some understanding, but I didn't have near the understanding that I had in my 30s. When I became a man in my 40s, my understanding increased with maturity. When I got into my 50s, my understanding became enlightened. Now that I'm in my 60s, I say, oh, wretched man that I am. Who would deliver me from this body of death? For the first time, Brother Smith, things are starting to hurt. And I didn't realize this until I turned 60 years old. Young people, they hurt on both sides, the upside and the downside. I had something called, Sister Hall, a biopsy. You know what a biopsy is, men? A biopsy is what we use to be able to ascertain what prostate cancer can be like and to be able to ascertain that it's not in your body. The doctor came out with a... Do they have 9-gauge needles, Gabe? The needle is so long, I ask him, what are you going to do with that? And I love physicians, they're so gifted. They said, it's going to be a little bit of pain. That's an oxymoron. There's no such thing as a little bit of pain. because at that moment I saw the needle. My pain level was at 9. The nurse touched me and we haven't done anything yet. I'm not making light of this. Because the older we do, we associate wisdom with being able to understand and handle things far better. I'd never crossed that road before, and all of a sudden, the very thing that I could master in my 20s, that is anything. And I'll give you an illustration. When I was in my 20s, I would do something like fly off an aircraft carrier and land on it. Do you know why we don't have people in their 30s and 40s and 50s doing that? Answer, because they know better. It will kill you. That is the craziest thing in the world. But yet, understanding changes throughout the cycle of life. The second thing is, my empathic reasoning changed. I begin now to see, just as Nehemiah has, in working with all the different people that would do all the different things that he did to be able to accomplish, to be more empathic with the person that has to work in the nursery. You ever wonder, Randy, why we don't get brothers volunteered to work in the nursery with their wives? Ask them. You will never know what it's like to deal with children until you yourself spend a significant amount of time with them during the early stages of their development. Diapers are God's gift to not using rags. It's perspective. Do you know what it's like to forgive others? I deal with a lot of people who are dealing with grief, death, and dying. And I'm good at what we call mortuary therapy. I've seen more people talk to dead people than I have people talking to people they need to talk to before they die. Talking to a cold vessel of a box of a person inside, confessing their sins. If you're there with them, get your iPhone and tape it so they can come back and hear it a little bit later. So we can teach and help others in how to forgive themselves. The difficulty with success is the journey starts over again. And our success is only a measure of how much more God has in store for us. It's not about conflict resolutions. Conflict resolutions are like fires. You put one out and another one emerges. And as they emerge, it doesn't change. And if you've noticed, if you've been here throughout all three of these presentations, there are some things here don't change. They just get refined. Nehemiah was a man of God. But as the man of God who is now dealing with the partnering with God, something miraculous begins to happen. And we see it enacted in verse number 38. And I say it this way. Nehemiah has come to this resolution. He said, because of all of this, we are making an agreement in writing, and our leaders, Levites, and priests are putting their seals on it. Then he says, in verse number 39, or chapter 10 rather, these are the men that seal the government and seal the agreement. And he lists at least 30 different verses of all the people that are involved in it. What's the application that we need to understand? In order for people to partner with God, we're in the environment and culture now where people have to commit themselves, you ready for this? Sometimes in writing. I was an elder in the church, Randy, and I asked the congregation as the shepherd of the church to make a commitment of their financial commitment to the church for the following year. One brother said, I'm not going to put it in writing what my commitment is because you might hold me to it. It is written and sealed. the writing of all things in partnerships having to be sealed. At one time, I didn't have to teach it this way. There was a time that a gospel preacher would come to work for a congregation of God's people, and it would be a handshake in terms of agreement. You know what happens now? Men and women will fire a preacher and his family and put him out on the street and then go feed the homeless the next week. Because they didn't partner with God. Writing was the confirmation that Nehemiah knew that men had his back. And it was executed. And that's what made it life. Our Lord has sealed his covenant with us in writing. The Old and New Testament of God is still a living document that has life, which is what we need in order to partner with God. And when we do that, here's the C word. We will start to continue to thrive. And it will look like this. The continuation will be as recorded in Nehemiah chapter 13, beginning at verse number 29. He said, remember them, my God, because they made the priesthood unclean and the agreement of the priest and the Levites unclean. He points them back to the history and telling the story. So I purified them of everything that was foreign. He's given them a challenge of what it would mean when the wall would be rebuilt. I purified them of everything that was foreign. I appointed duties for the priests and Levites, giving each man his own job. Thank you. That's why I use a lapel mic. I also made sure wood and brought for the altar at regular times, and the first fruits were brought. I like this version because it says this, in the last verse of the book that was written, ascribed by Nehemiah, he says, remember me, my God, be kind to me. Remember me, be kind to me. When we see God's power of one, I use a molecule of the human body to show this. That's a DNA molecule, but one cell. Look at all the various components in it, doing its job, working together to carry out the thriving of God's plan. Final point, and I'll open it up for questions. Never take yourself for granted. Never disregard your service and work. Put yourself in a position to be used by God and allow him to use you to his glory so much so that it will become evident in your own life as well as the lives of others. The blessing that comes from partnering with God will result in you being able to handle anything that God brings you, regardless of the time of your life. I'm going to give you an opportunity to do something now that's seldom done. Ask me anything you want. Anything. When we're talking about this idea of the off-centeredness of survival, I want to take you back to my wall. Here's a wall. The word survival comes from a Latin word that gives us the idea of being able to overcome something that typically would keep you from being able to stay alive. We survive, as in gone through. Now, when we're looking at it from off-center, we have to look at it from two perspectives. One is an expectation perspective. Example, when we go out and get in our car and turn on the ignition and we take off, we have an expectation that we will be able to drive successfully from point A to point B using a pattern that's already been structured and that framework therein. But in order to survive, we may have to deviate from our route. And in order to do that, we have to change direction, not disregarding the path that we were to be on, but change in order for survival to occur. Said another way, when we apply it in practical relationships, sometimes in our court systems, even though we are innocent, but because of the circumstances, we may have to deviate from center by taking a plea bargain in order for the best good to come, rather than the potential or propensity of destruction to occur in order for survival to occur. That's kind of the context that I meant that in. Great question, insightful. Young people, when I was an undergraduate student, I wanted to ask my professor a lot of things and wouldn't. Here's your chance. Yes, sir. From whose perspective? The person who is being mentored or the person who is doing the mentoring? Yes. Let's start with mentoring first. Mentoring involves three concepts. The first one is time. You have to have to allow time to be mentored. Now, I learned how to drive a nuclear submarine. Now, a submarine is an oval-shaped vessel. It doesn't operate like an airplane, but it has principles similar. But in order to do it, it requires time. It requires 22 hours per week. 22 hours a week to practice it. Now, in order to do it, you have to have a commanding officer who is willing to mentor, because most COs don't want a novice driver to hit their ship. So, while I was in the Navy, we used something like simulators. Now, I know your focus is on the person who's doing the mentoring, but the person who's doing the mentoring cannot do the work. It is the person who is being mentored that must be able to do the work. Now, I'll use this in the context of how I mentor interns in my counseling profession. I give them a video camera. I give them a client. They have the tools, the gifts, and the talents. The only thing that they're lacking is the confidence. And I close the door and let them do it and mess up somebody's family over and over and over again. And then they go back and look at themselves to see how they've messed up. Now, in order to do that, that requires my time. And I teach from this perspective. What did you see? Did you enjoy the way you presented this case? Did you like the way you asked that question? That's the mentoring and the mentoring process. So we have to find someone who's willing to give you the time. And this is how we do it in the counseling profession. Ready for this? We get it in writing. When an intern comes to work with me, they agree that they're going to work so many hours a week, and I put in writing how many hours a week I will dedicate and give to them. The commitment works that. It is not following someone from afar that says, I like the way you teach, or I like the way you preach, or the way you present things, and I want to hang around with you. No, it has to be strategic, it has to be structured, and there has to be a point. But the first point is, I go back to my Navy illustrations a lot in illustrating this. But what they do in the Navy, in Navy officer programs, they line up everyone and they ask them one question. Can you swim? Now, believe it or not, some people are terrified of swimming and they will lie. And they will say yes. And in reality, they can't. As soon as they say yes, there's somebody behind them and they push them in the water. And in 20 feet of water, it's a little bit too late to make up your mind and say, I'm sorry, I wasn't telling the truth. The mentoring occurs because underneath the water are two divers waiting. And then they will mentor you by bringing you up and keeping you in the water until you start to swim. I've seen people learn how to swim in 7 minutes. I've seen others take 7 weeks. That's a brief conceptualization of how to answer your question. Was it sufficient? Okay, follow up. The time? They're within the same context. One who's willing to do it, which is commitment, and the other is availability. Now, I want to put it in a preaching context. May I? When you get a preacher to mentor you, he'll give you his pulpit. Go on up there, son. Make a fool of yourself. Say whatever you want. Now, he acknowledges that you've gone through the practice, the sermon development, the tools that you've used, and you'd be wise. Now, the mentoring comes contrary to the work that he would do himself. He said, you have 15 minutes to produce this message. And here's why I said that. The person that mentored me in preaching never let me preach in the church until I had preached 10 years. Well, 7 years. I learned how to preach on the street. And I had the same message. The renowned Jimmy Allen taught me this. You don't need but one. You just need to be good and work every time.